you. So, first off, this is not an easy thing for me to do. I am a mathematician. I am not a philosopher. I'm not used to talking about mathematics, about feelings about mathematics, as opposed to doing mathematics. I have three quotes from you from very well-known, well-respected research mathematicians. Paul Erdős said, "Why are numbers beautiful? It's like asking why Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is beautiful. If you don't see why, someone can't tell you. I know numbers are beautiful. If they aren't, nothing is." Okay, so it's hard to explain what you mean about beauty. And from that quote, you might think, okay, I have a losing proposition here. I can't succeed. I can't tell you. G.H. Hardy, another mathematician, says, "We may not know what we mean by a beautiful poem, but that does not prevent us from recognizing one when we see it." Okay, so I have a sense of when I think something mathematical is beautiful, and maybe when it isn't, at least to me. Poincaré said the mathematician does not study pure mathematics because it is useful. He studies it because he delights in it. And he delights in it because it's beautiful. Did I misquote that? Did I say useful or beautiful in the first phrase? Useful. Good, I said it correctly. So he delights in it. And he delights in it because it's beautiful. So I want to give you some sense of what I delight in terms of mathematics. Some people say math is pure, austere beauty. It brings together disparate objects in some sort of harmonious way. It's delightful in the patterns that it exposes and makes sense of. There's symmetry that it sees in unexpected places. These are the sorts of things that make me delight in mathematics. So one thing I can do is I can show you a lot of pretty pictures. So I can show you things like the Mandelbrot set. This is a fractal. It's hopefully beautiful to you. I mean, it looks beautiful to me. It's kind of stunning. And kind of catches you unaware that sort of some basic ideas in math are used to build this beautiful picture. Or we can look at something like Escher's representation of the Poincaré disk model of hyperbolic geometry. There's so much symmetry in there, and yet, I mean, this is a mathematical thing. It's a model of a kind of geometry. It's pure mathematics. These curves you see are representing in that model straight lines. Well, that's unexpected. Those don't look like straight lines in Euclidean geometry, in the geometry we're accustomed to. So there's unexpected things happening in there. There's symmetry. There's some patterns that you see. You see the fishes all coming together in various places, but they get smaller as you go out. There's changes, subtle changes in that pattern. That's appealing to me. Here's a fractal in a rock. So, you know, random old rock, well, not quite so random, picked up off the ground when I was a child. And there's a fractal living in there. These are natural things in some sense. Somebody said, nature delights in simplicity. And I find myself in mathematics responding to things that can be described in some sort of simple way, but have real depth. Here's another mathematical object. This is a blown glass representation of a Klein bottle. A Klein bottle really doesn't live in three space. This is something that is in three space, so this isn't a perfect representation, but it's kind of a pretty piece of glass. Representing something that in topology and mathematics is very pathological. And so, to me, surprisingly beautiful. But that's not what I really mean when I talk about beauty. I don't mean just pretty pictures. As a mathematician, what I'm looking at, what I'm responding to, are statements of fact and proofs of those statements. So that's what I want to give you a better sense of, maybe a better sense of, than what the pretty pictures show. So here is a mathematical fact called Euler's identity. It's a simple little equation, e to the I pi plus 1 equals 0. All it's saying is that two numbers are equal. It's, in some sense, simple. And yet, inside of that equation are really an amazing bunch of ideas. So what is 0? 0 is an additive identity for the integers. What is 1? Well, if that doesn't mean anything to you, think about what you think of 0 meaning. What is 1? 1 is the multiplicative identity for the integers. Or think of what you mean by 1. You know, 1 Klein bottle. 0 Klein bottles, none. What do you mean by 0 and 1? If you start thinking about those ideas, you realize those numbers have more going on in them than maybe you thought of as a first grader. E, what's E? Well, there's lots of different definitions of E. E can be defined as the limit as x goes to 0, I'm looking down here now, of the function 1 plus x to the 1 over x. 1 plus x to the 1 over x, that's a function that isn't a power function and it isn't an exponential function. It's got a variable in both the base and the denominator, so it's a fairly complicated function. It's not easy to work with, and if you've had some calculus or something, you might have realized that at some point, that this is not simple. And yet, when you take the limit as x approaches 0, now 1 over x, that exponent, is undefined at 0. So that's something complicated going on there. You take that limit and you get some number. That limit exists. It does produce some number. As x gets closer and closer to 0, the 1 plus x to the 1 over x approaches a number. We call that number e. It is irrational. It's not a natural number. It's not an integer. It's a strange number. It's a special number. It's a number that appears all over the place in mathematics and in applications of mathematics. I is the square root of negative 1, and you've probably been told many times that you're not allowed to do that. Of course, they lied to you. And I've lied to some of you about that. But in mathematics, you say, well, okay, wait a minute. What happens if we do it anyway? And call it I and see what happens. Well, it turns out beautiful things happen. All of complex analysis, a huge area in mathematics happens. And complex analysis is amazingly cool. But I is the square root of negative 1. Pi, you could think of it as the area of a circle of radius 1. So you've got these three numbers, e, I, and pi, that are completely different. It doesn't look like they should be related in any way. One's an area, one's this weird, not allowed square root of negative 1. One's a limit of some weird function. And yet this simple, little, elegant equation puts them all together in this amazing way. So we have a very economical equation describing a much deeper result than it should possibly be able to. That's beautiful. I don't want to just talk about results, though. I want to also look at how those results get proved. And that's where it really gets exciting to me. So I want to look at something, though, that's familiar to you, the Pythagorean theorem. So you've probably known this theorem or could recall this theorem from, middle school? Maybe even earlier than that? Do you know this thing in grade school? I mean, this has been around forever. You learn it early. It's a theorem you learn in geometry. And what it says is that if you have a right triangle, so the blue triangle there is a right triangle with sides A, B, and C, where C is the longest side, the hypotenuse, then those numbers, those lengths, are related by this equation, A squared plus B squared equals C squared. Again, a fairly simple equation, and just an equation. There's no words involved in some sense, it's just a simple equation. And it's relating the lengths of a right triangle. but it's also talking about areas. So if we think about the C squared, if C is the side of a square with sides length C, all the sides length C, then C squared is the area of that square. And similarly, A squared would be the area of a square, and B squared would be the area of a square. So this is also a statement about areas. You could also think of it in terms of sort of a number theoretic perspective. So it's talking about when the sum of two perfect squares, A squared and B squared, is itself a perfect square. So for what kinds of integers do you get that relationship between those integers? So there's a lot of different perspectives you can look at this thing from and think of it in very different ways. But why is it true? So if you have a right triangle, why is it true that A squared plus B squared equals C squared? There's literally hundreds of proofs of this thing. But I'm going to show you one proof. So I'm going to arrange my triangle this way. This is C, this is A, and this is B, and this is my right angle. And off of each of those sides, I'm going to build a square. So this is a square with side length A. And so the area of this square is A squared. And I build a square off of this side. And you have to pretend that all my squares are really squares. I'm a topologist. To me, a square like that is as good as any other square. Okay, just a square. Okay, so the area of that square is B squared, and I build a square off this side, and its area is C squared. So I want to think of some way to show that the sum of these two areas, so the stuff inside this square plus the stuff inside this square, will fill up all of this square, so that the sum of the two areas are equal to the sum of, or the area of this square. And so what do I do when I'm trying to prove something? I start playing with it, and I think really hard, and I try some stuff, and I have flashes of insight and, you know, moments of great creativity, and I discover things that are true. You might wonder about whether math is created or discovered. That's a good topic. And eventually, I go, oh, wait, I see. Here's what we can do. So this is, you know, after a lot of work. So the green square up there is the area the square with side length A. And if I take that green square and I break it up in that way and I move those pieces down here, I can create this green rectangle. So the darkest piece just slides down to there. This pale piece just slides down to there. That little one comes down here, and the littler one, or the slightly bigger one up there, comes down there and creates a rectangle. And you could check that I haven't changed the size of any of those things, and it really does fit together perfectly into that rectangle. So that entire A squared amount of area is sitting right here in my square of side length C. And similarly, I can do the blue square. I can break it up into three pieces, two of them are triangles, slide this one to here, slide that one to there, and the pale blue one down to here. And so I've shown that those two areas together create the entire area inside of the square of side length C. So the sum of those two areas is this area. So A squared plus B squared is C squared. Wow! And it kind of hits me in the gut, and I say, wow, that is so simple. And it shows this incredibly deep result in such a simple way. And I like it. And to me, it's beautiful. Okay? Now, it may not be beautiful to you. We all respond to different things. But I'm hoping that I'm giving you a sense of that, that moment of seeing it, of understanding and realizing how this simple thing builds this statement, A squared plus B squared equals C squared, that has so much meaning in it and so much use, which is not something I usually care too much about. Here's another one that also has a lot of use and is amazing in that way. So I want to talk a little bit about the fundamental theorem of calculus. This is one that really gets to me. So as you're going through calculus, you learn about a derivative. And you don't necessarily need to know what that is today. I'll tell you a little bit about it. If it doesn't make any sense, that's okay. A derivative of a function f is given by this formula. The limit as h goes to 0, f of x plus h minus f of x over h. What the heck is that? This f of x plus h minus f of x over h is slope. It's just the slope formula. For the secant line here, it's the purple line. So f is considered to be this green curve. And then the secant line has slope given by that quotient. This is x plus h. So it's just the line through the two points on the curve at x and x plus h. And then what we want to do is let h go to 0. That means we want to let this distance shrink. So this point, x plus h, is moving towards x in that limiting process. And so what we're doing is we're calculating the slope of this line as the line changes. That slope changes, and what is that slope doing? It's approaching the slope of what's called the tangent line, which is a line that sort of touches the curve right here at x, f of x, and tries to mimic the curve as best it can with a linear function. But what is it? It's just an idea of slope. And what is slope? Slope is rate of change. It's how something is changing with respect to time, say. So it's kind of like speed. So derivative is a rate of change defined in terms of slopes. What is an integral? So as you go through calculus, you learn about integral or derivatives, you do a bunch of calculation, play with these things, and you get lost and you lose the definition. And then you jump to integrals and you talk about integrals. Well, what's an integral? An integral, so here I have another curve, f of x. And the integral measures the area under the curve over some interval. So an integral is really just an area. And the way it does it is it breaks that area up into small rectangles, skinny rectangles. They might be tall. And it calculates the area of each rectangle. So the f of xi delta x is the width of the rectangle. F of xi is the height of the rectangle. So length times width, area of a rectangle. That's the area of one of the little rectangles. This symbol says add up all the rectangles. This limit says let the width of those rectangles go to 0 so that you're putting more and more and more in there. As you put more and more in there, the part of the area under the curve that you're missing gets filled in and you end up with the exact area. So what is an integral? It's an area under a curve. What does area have to do with rate of change? Apparently nothing. It doesn't look like it. They shouldn't be related. I mean, one's a slope, one's an area. Who would ever think that they had any relationship between them? And very brilliant people were able to prove the fundamental theorem of calculus. I won't talk about the proof, but let's look at what it says. In essence, it says the integral of the derivative of a function has something to do with the function itself. So in some sense, the integral undoes the derivative of the function, and you're just left with the function. And in some sense, the derivative of the integral of the function just gives you the function back. Okay, these aren't exactly what's happening, but it's the idea of what's happening. So the fundamental theorem of calculus is telling you that integral and derivative are very, very intimately related in some sort of opposite way. They're inverses of each other. One undoes what the other did and gives you back what you started with. They're like black and white. And it's very unexpected that they would be related at all. And yet they're related in this simple, elegant way, and in just two little statements, you can say so much. And this is the heart of calculus, and most of you know calculus is a big, useful subject, so this is really important. And yet it's just this beautiful little statement. Okay. And in case you got lost in me trying to tell you how mathematics feels to me, here's some more pretty pictures. So this is a representation of the of a group. Okay, what's a group? I'm not going to tell you. E8, so this is a mathematical object, and I think many of us would say, yeah, that's really beautiful. It's got symmetry, it's got, I'll let you look. I suspect I'm pretty well out of time, so let me give you another one. I like Escher. One of Escher's renditions of a sphere. A sphere in topology is a very basic, important building block. So not so pathological as the Klein bottle, but really central. And Penrose tiling. So this is a way of covering the entire plane with little pieces. There's only, what is there? There's only two kinds of pieces. There's these little rhombus-looking things and these little green ones. So there's blue ones and green ones, and the entire plane is covered with those things. You can continue the pattern out forever. And this is a mathematical object that seems to have a lot of beauty associated to it. And finally, another fractal, the Julia set, which I enjoy. Okay, I should stop or we will run out of time completely.